I'm Mike Collins. The stock market has soared for most of 2014, but we've had some precipitous dips in recent weeks, with the market falling from record highs for a variety of reasons. Given that we're just coming out of a major recession, dips like this can set your teeth on edge if you're an investor or if you have money waiting in 401ks for that day when you retire. Have these gyrations been some crazy dips based on irrational concerns or investors taking profits or some sort of a market correction? And how much attention should you pay to it? We take a look at that this hour with two of the city's leading financial planners. But we've really asked them to join us for some long-range planning, beginning with your children. We want to talk to them about talking to kids about money. How much should children know about how money works in our capitalist system? When should they know it? And if this next generation is likely to be the first not to do as well as their parents, could you actually reverse that? If you had them start saving, then investing, and understanding how to wisely spend their money, how to make smart use of debt. Well, we've invited Larry Carroll and Bill Staten to join us again. Larry is president and CEO of Carroll Financial Associates. He and his 34-year-old company have both received national recognition on numerous occasions and have nearly $2 billion in assets under management by 14 certified financial planners. Welcome back.
Thanks, Mike.
Bill Staten is a chartered financial analyst and managing director and chief investment officer for Staten Financial Advisors and author of 6 books on investing, including his most recent, Double Your Money in America's Finest Companies, and Worry-Free Finances, which he wrote with his wife, Mary. Good morning. Welcome.
Well, thank you, Mike.
Let's start here. Up until recently, 2014 had been a very good year in the stock market. Why?
Well, I think there are a lot of things. We came from a deep, deep undervalued situation back in late 2008 and early 2009. And as Larry and I were talking about before the show started, interest rates have been falling since 1981, since they peaked, and they're not nearly as much competition for high-quality stocks, just as an example, AT&T or something like that, as they were some years ago.
So it hasn't been irrational exuberance.
No, I think the economy continues to get better.
Slowly.
But the pace of getting better seems to be increasing at this point. So, you know, you look at things that that help companies make more money, and they're out there. They're in place, an improving economy, low interest rates. This is a pretty good situation.
But then you have these little dips that we had. We had these big fall-offs in the last couple of Fridays, in weeks leading up to Friday. Nothing like 2008, but scary nonetheless for some people. News reports jitters over the Middle East and the Israeli-Gaza situation and the Russian-Ukraine conflicts. Do fears like these make sense?
No.
No.
Because in the long run, things go up. I remember July of 1982 was the start of the longest, strongest bull market that this country has ever seen, and it didn't peak out until late 1999, early 2000, depending on what you owned. And the Dow was around 666, and then it went up just, you know, it just went up and up and up. But during that period of time, we had the crash of 87, 23% one-day drop. We had in 1990 what is now Citigroup almost went under. 1998, long-term capital management went under and almost dragged the entire global financial system down. We had the Kuwaiti war. I mean, there's always something to worry about.
Yeah, I think the thing I would add to that is as of Friday's close, we're up 5.7% year to date. That's pretty good. I mean, you annualize that out, you get about 10 for the year, which is a good return. And the decline this year from top to bottom is about 4%. That's nothing.
Yeah.
And we still have a good year. I think the big point of that is, and Bill alluded to this, people spend too much time trying to predict what the market is going to do in the next 30 days. And it's really about the next 30 years. Go look at a 30-year chart and see. There's never been a 20-year period when stocks were down. But you have to learn to get through the corrections and the ups and downs of the market and not look at them as kind of the end of the world.
And when you say there's never been a 20-year period when stocks were down, what is that period? When did they start keeping records?
Well, you can go – well, Jeremy Siegel at the Wharton School goes back to 1834.
So it's not just the post-World War II.
No, it is not just post-World War II. It includes the Depression.
Okay.
Which I think is your question.
Well, that and also the 19th century, which had a significant number of recessions and depressions. You folks, the two of you, deal with ordinary investors of various different level of wealth. And you're saying that we shouldn't be concerned about this. But the reason these dips in the market take place based on fears over the Ukraine-Russian conflict are these big institutional investors who get cold feet. These people are supposed to be experts. Why are they frightened if you say we shouldn't be?
Well, in a lot of cases, they are the second derivative of what's going on with the individual investor. For example, if you're managing a mutual fund, you may have to sell because investors are taking money out. You may not have any choice in the matter. So part of it is a derivative. Companies run by committees are subject to, in a lot of cases, are subject to the same emotional reactions to markets that individuals are because they're made up of individuals. So it can't make all that go away. But your point's well taken. You will get some selling at different levels in that situation. I think the most important thing I can tell you about this process is you need to stop trying to predict corrections and start preparing for corrections.
How?
Having the right amount of risk in the portfolio, having an amount in stocks that you can sleep with at night, meaning that it's not every penny that you've got so that if the market goes down 10%, you can't sleep that night. It's about having good dividend paying stocks in the portfolio because they don't tend to go down as much during corrections.
That's true.
It's building an approach that you can be satisfied with and content with long term.
And that depends on your individual risk assessment and also where you are in life, I take it.
Well, that's true, but it also depends on whether you get fearful. There's some people, I used to be terrified to fly on airplanes until I flew back to Charlotte one day with a retired pilot who said turbulence should not be a worry because turbulence does not destroy airplanes, even if it's severe. Now, you can get injured in severe turbulence if you're not fastened in your seatbelt or you're dancing in the aisle or something like that. But turbulence just – ask any pilot. Turbulence does not destroy airplanes. And all through history, we're going to have turbulence that's going to produce negative emotions in people, causing them sometimes to get freaky. But I'll give you a simple example. When Larry's talking about the long term, we always tell our clients that solid companies trump bad economics and bad politics. And here's an example. Valspar, the paint company, DuPont, and John Wiley & Sons, which published my last book, all started in business in this country when Thomas Jefferson was president. And they're still doing the same stuff they did over 200 years ago. And what have we gone through lately that's worse than the Civil War, for example?
Yeah.
It's just not that bad.
You know, the market also seems to dip on good news because a couple of months ago, I think it was, there was some flurry of activity around the Fed and some suspicion that the Fed, because the economy was getting better, might let interest rates stop being artificially suppressed. And that sent the market into a tizzy because that means you couldn't make as much money. I mean, what's wrong with people like this? I mean, isn't it inevitable that interest rates are going to go up at some point because they are at remarkable lows and have been for years?
Yes, I do think it's inevitable. I don't think it's inevitable that that makes the market fall apart. We'll have higher interest rates, but it's going to take them a while to move up. And that doesn't necessarily translate into this being a terrible market. I think the market will hold up fairly well if it happens in an orderly manner.
Mike, from 41 to 81, interest rates rose steadily until they hit all-time highs in 1981. Stocks did the typical 10 or 11% a year. Since 81, they plummeted to record lows, and stocks have done over that period about 10 or 11% a year. What's the difference? Stocks have done about the same either way.
You don't like bonds, do you?
Bonds can be useful, and I'll tell you how they can be. And Larry, I'm sure, knows this better than me. if you look at all the years going back to 1929, with only two exceptions, every year stocks have been down, bonds have been up. So in the short run, bonds can be that kind of buffer. But here's a statistic that I brought. I want to share this with the audience. If we go back to that bubble in March of 2000, and you started your investment program and you bought high-grade bonds and reinvested your coupons, or you bought the Dow Industrials and reinvested dividends, to date you've made more money in the Dow Industrials than you did in bonds, and we've been through the two worst bear markets since the 1930s.
So if interest rates rise, do bonds become more attractive?
Well, they may, but you know, if anybody wants to talk about a bubble today, the bubble's in the bond market.
Yeah,
it's not in the stock market. And I think if things get bad in the bond market, they may get really bad for this reason. It's not just about interest rates. Interest rates going up will make bond prices go down. But if you start to get significant selling in the bond market, there will be problems this time that have not existed in the past for two reasons. One is the bond market is about twice as big as it was 10 years ago.
And bigger than the stock market.
Right, bigger than the stock market.
Way bigger.
The second piece of it is that when we went through the recession in 08 and 09 and the banks had all their problems, the banks had to shrink their balance sheet and increase their capital. So in the past, if you sold a bond, the bond desk at a bank would buy that bond. The bond desk does not want to buy a bond now. They don't have as much capital available. They want to match you up with
someone
on the other side.
Yeah.
They don't buy it into inventory. The analogy is you've got an auditorium that now has twice as many people in it, and the doors are narrower to get out. So if you get dislocation in the bond market, it could be bad this time.
And people have gone to bonds because they're afraid of stocks because of what happened in the 2008 recession?
That's true. And Bill and I would tell you we think they've done the wrong thing there.
It's incredible how many people think if you own bonds or bond funds, very smart people, that you can't lose money.
They're always surprised when they lose money in bonds.
They just think it. And they don't remember 1994. We had a collapse in the bond market that was the worst year since 1928.
They raised rates six times, if I remember
correctly. Eight times. The Fed raised rates eight times that year.
So given everything we've talked about so far, because when we come back from the break, we're going to talk about kids and investing for kids and teaching kids about money. Everything we've talked about in the market, where we are today, where we are with the economy, should people be confident for the short term, confident for the long term?
Well, what's your alternative is really the question. I mean, surely we've got enough nuclear weapons to destroy the planet many times over. But assuming the world doesn't come to an end, then you've got to have something to make your principal grow, and you've got to keep ahead of the two bugaboos for everybody, which are taxes and inflation. You've just got to be able to do something. You cannot do that in a savings account or just stashing money, you know, in your backyard in a tin can or something.
Yeah, I would say that in the short term, it doesn't matter.
Mm-hmm.
That you need to be focused on the long term, and the long term, they should be optimistic.
Larry Carroll and Bill Staton with us when we come back. Kids and Money, Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Mr. Rogers Windows, a local family business since 1986, offering renewal by Anderson replacement windows and entry door systems installed by trained craftsmen. Product details at MrRogersWindows.com. Well, for years we've been hearing about the sorry state of America's infrastructure. This state included, by the way, the American Society of Civil Engineers issues a report card on a regular basis, and the grades are out. The results are mixed at best, and our state, along with much of the rest of the country, gets barely a passing grade. So we'll talk about what's wrong, what needs to be done, how much it will cost, what the stakes are if we do or don't, tomorrow at 9.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, an experimental drug given to two Americans who contracted Ebola, has sparked controversy over who gets treatment. An update on the effectiveness of the drug and efforts to contain the spread of the deadly virus.
Join the Diane Rehm Show this morning from 10 to noon after Charlotte Talks on 90.7 WFAE, Charlotte's NPR news source.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about money today and investing, specifically investing. But more specifically now, as for the rest of the program, we're going to talk about kids and investing and what kids should know about money, when they should know it, what they should know about investing, etc. With Larry Carroll, President and CEO of Carroll Financial Associates, and Bill Staton, Managing Director and Chief Investment Officer with Staton Financial Associates. You read a lot of stories about people in certain generations who wake up one day and realize that they haven't saved enough for their retirement, and people are living longer than ever before, and Social Security is paltry when you compare it to a lot of salaries, and if you haven't put money aside, that's what you're going to be living on unless you continue to work. That could be short-circuited substantially, it seems to me, if kids began to save, or if you began to save for your children and then turn that saving process over to them at some point.
We did that with my two daughter, my son and my daughter when they were little, because the ability to directly invest into companies like IBM and Coca-Cola has been around for 30, 40, maybe longer than that.
And by directly invest, you mean not
buy the stock directly through the company.
Don't call a broker.
You don't need a broker.
Don't do a computer day trader thing. Just call the company.
And we started, one of our two daughters. This is one I remember. Her original investment into McDonald's in 1994, 20 years ago, without adding any money, but reinvesting the dividends, which is automatically done in direct investing. It's called dividend reinvestment, or DRIP.
So instead of them sending you a check every quarter, they just take that money and put it back. They buy more stock.
The under $100 initial investment, Mike, is worth more than $6,000 today, which is not bad.
No, it's not bad.
Well, I think one of the implied points in what Bill said is you try to get them started with things they identify with, like McDonald's.
Or Hasbro.
Pepsi, Electronic
Coke,
Arts.
Hershey.
Pepsi, yeah, all those things.
Apple.
But Apple works now. Yeah. I don't know whether they have a drip or not. Things that they identify with and use themselves, I think they're going to look at it more as a learning experience when you have that situation.
Is that a key for adults, too? If you see something that's really hot, like Starbucks, is that a good investment? Because you see a big line at the door, is that a good investment?
Well, it depends on what you pay for, but over a longer run, if it's a quality, it's not so critical if you've got, for a child, got a 60, 70-year investment horizon,
right.
So it's not so much a danger that you're overpaying. The question is the company's longer term sustainable? And you would think for Starbucks, it probably is.
So would you suggest that when a child is born or when a child has an annual birthday, that along with the present that you give the child in the hand, you put some money in an investment account or a savings account? How would you start?
Well, our kids, maybe we're different, but we had two deals when they lived with us. Thankfully, they don't live with us anymore, the four of them. But
that's because you put money aside.
But if they earned any money or were given any money and they gave it back to us, remember they were under 18, so we had to. We would say we'll double it. So we give you $100, you give us $50 back. We double that and put $100 into Coke or whatever. And we got them involved early. When they were 7 or 8, picking companies that were good. Our daughter wanted to buy a yogurt company, and there weren't any publicly traded yogurt companies at the time, so I think she chose Coca-Cola. And that worked quite well, and we've done the same thing with our two grandsons. On top of that, every January I send the same dollar amount to one of their companies for each of the six, the four adult children and the two grandsons, and that is their birthday present.
Mm-hmm. Larry?
Yeah, I want to make maybe the most important point in this discussion. I don't want us to get totally sidetracked on the idea of teaching your children about investing. It's much more about teaching your children about good money management.
Responsibility.
Responsible. Spend less than you make. Save something. Debt management. Those are probably bigger issues for most young people than the idea of what stock to buy. Because those are lifelong habits.
Yeah, I think it was an article that you wrote that I read, Larry, about piggy banks. You advocate giving a child an allowance and encouraging them to put that money in a piggy bank and then empower them to manage their own money. And I was surprised about the piggy bank because it doesn't pay interest the last time I checked.
Okay. What we would do, you're right, but neither does a money market fund.
You got to buy a different piggy bank, Mike.
Here's the point we would make with the piggy bank. We think the piggy bank should be divided into four sections, or you may have four different piggy banks, to have the child focus on the different uses for the money. Some of the money is for spending. Some is for saving for larger purchases and long range. Some is for donations to begin to teach them about charity and helping others. And some of it is about investing. And there, you educate on all four of those, not just on one piece of it. If they got in the habit of saving 10%, I'm sorry, not saving, investing 10%, saving 30 to 40, spending 30 to 40, you've made a lot of progress.
We did a program about a month or so ago about getting people out of poverty. And one of the things that became clear in that conversation is that the first step is to save. Well, to get your spending under control, then to save. Then to invest, because you can't invest unless you have savings.
That's right.
So talk about the difference between those two things, because people don't understand that. I didn't understand.
You've got to have money left over. And there was when Tommy Tomlinson was a columnist for the Observer, one of his last columns was he went to a second grade here in Charlotte, and he said, if you were president, what would you do to make the country better? And one kid said, well, when you come home every day, you get ice cream. Another one said, you know, you ought to be able to drive a car when you're seven. And this one kid said, I love it. Now, think about 7 or 8-year-old. He says, you've got your needs and you've got your wants. You need your needs, but you don't need your wants. You have to know the difference.
Wow.
And we, right, in America, with and probably in more advanced nations, we're just consumed with consuming and running up debt on credit cards and buying stuff on sale and things that that we don't really need. We convert a lot of needs, we convert a lot of wants into needs, and then we trick ourselves into going out and buying those things.
Well, we're told in commercials, you deserve.
You've got to have it.
Yeah.
And you're special.
That's right.
Everybody in your generation.
So, since a lot of parents, a lot of adults, don't have a lot of money, we don't do a good job of monetary education in this country. Kids do not learn about checkbooks and bank accounts and saving and don't buying on credit. They don't learn that in school. So their parents didn't learn it in school. They learn it in the school of hard knocks. Some of them worse than others, and some don't take the lessons to heart. So as a parent, where do you begin with a child? What do you start teaching them first, and how do you learn it yourself?
Well, my father and his father and my great uncle were all bankers in Eastern North Carolina, and what they were involved in later became Wachovia, which then became part of Wells Fargo. But I really didn't get any particular lessons in saving money or budgeting or anything like that. And when Mary and I married 20 years ago, she was the one who started saying, we've got to keep track of where our money goes. And that's a simple thing to do. I've been teaching at the county jail now. This is my 6th year. And one of the things I say, we all waste money. Raise your hand if you can honestly tell me you don't waste at least $50 a month. And out of 2,500 or so men, I've never seen a hand go up. Now, what does that mean? If you're wasting at least $50 a month, that's over $600 a year, and I'm not even including addictive things like alcohol and cigarettes and stuff like that. So I say, take around a little sheet of paper or card, and every time you spend a dollar or more for a week or so, write down where your money goes. It's incredible. $5 here for a cup of coffee, which you could make at home for 25 cents, you know, those types of things. Mm-hmm. We need to know where our money goes and cut out a lot of the waste.
So start there. Start by keeping track for a week or two or three or four of where your money, what you're spending money on, and take stock of that.
And some good apps that will help you with that now.
Like?
And I think it's Mint.com.
Yeah, Mint.com. Is it secure? I mean, you're putting your money out there.
Is anything secure on the Internet? Who knows?
All right. So Mint.com is a good place to start. What about kids learn a lot through games. Are there, aside from Monopoly, which teaches you how to buy
and Larry's cheats, a gamer. I don't know.
Are there games that kids can play that they can learn about how money is used in society?
The Great Piggy Bank Adventure.
Really?
Piggybank.disney.go.com.
Piggybank.disney.go.com. Okay.
Feedthepig.org. You know, they're out there if you want to help use an app to help with this process or a website.
Huh. And they will teach kids what about how money is used to buy and
those four different things I mentioned
saving
that
and
they
debt
can be used for. Yeah. Huh.
Are these difficult concepts for kids to learn?
No. Kids will jump all over it, but we've got to have the parents or the guardians, we've got to have them provide the lead. And you've got to, you know, your children, grandkids don't want you to talk to them. They want you to show by example. And I remember Mary told a great story when she was younger. She wanted this blouse that everybody else had. And she sat down with her dad, had a lot of children, and said, well, let's see if it fits into the budget. And he went through everything kind of item by item by item. He said, we just don't have enough money to do it, but maybe 3 months down the road we will if you kick in a little bit or whatever. And that's an example I've heard her use several times, and it resonates. And it was just a little inexpensive
blouse. You can also use that to teach children the idea of earning money to accomplish certain specific things, to buy the blouse or
Well, teenagers, from about 11 on, kids become very aware of things and what their friends have, whether it's a new blouse or a new outfit or a new basketball or whatever. And they want it too. So this is a good opportunity to teach them, if they have an allowance, okay, you want that basketball? Here's how you get there.
Here's how you get there.
I used to mow, half dozen lawns every week, made, I think, all of $7. And I worked in the cucumber market for a couple of years, worked in the tobacco market for a couple of years, and it was very hard labor and didn't pay.
That was in the 16th century. So,
no, it was the 1500s, Mike.
So today, should parents feel guilty about, if a kid wants, they want a new
iPhone.
I mean, should they feel guilty about saying, okay, well, here's what the iPhone is going to cost on our plan, and if you want that iPhone, you're going to have to kick in or you're going to have to do it all, and here's how you're going to have to get there. You're going to have to save this amount of money every month, blah, blah, blah. Should they feel guilty about making the kid go through that process as opposed to just saying, okay, you want the iPhone, here it is?
I don't know that guilt is particularly useful in anything. I think it gets back to what Larry and I are talking about, the reality of the situation. Number one, is it really a need or is it just something you want because everybody else has it? I'm going to make two suggestions here. Mary and I came up with a program called the $50 a Month Millionaire, which is free, and we've given away thousands of PDF copies all over the world, and you can get it at our website, stateandfinancial.com. I'm also going to suggest just a few blocks up the street at Boy Scout headquarters, there is a wonderful booklet, and you don't have to be a Boy Scout to buy it, called Personal Management. It's a merit badge if you're a scout, and I'm a personal management merit badge counselor. But it is short, it's instructive, and one of the big things is, as a family, they have to come up with a project, like we need to buy a car for the 16-year-old. How are we going to get the money? And the last scout that I coached on this merit badge, which is a toughie, actually, they made it. They didn't make up a thing. They made up a. It was a real example of they came up with how they're going to all sacrifice to be able to buy a car for the kid.
No, the
personal management merit badge.
The concepts that we're talking about are not difficult.
It's not rocket science.
Although people do struggle with it because they were never taught as children, and we still aren't taught. Why isn't this taught in schools? Why isn't the concept of the cost of money, incurring debt, etc., why isn't that taught?
Well, I don't think there's a good reason. We are starting to see more of it. Several colleges that I'm aware of have put in as a freshman class kind of an introduction to personal
financial. But it's college.
I understand, Mike. I agree with you.
Better late than never.
But they seem to be the ones that are a little bit more responsive to the idea at this point than secondary education seems to be. I think it needs to filter down. There are some organizations set up to work on that, but it doesn't tend to be, at this point in time, a real class. It's more about having a speaker like Bill or someone mm-hmm. come in and do 50 minutes on mm-hmm. personal money management rather than a class.
You suggest, Larry, setting up a checking account for a teenager. And the purpose of that would be what?
I think they need to learn to manage that money. And to be involved in it. They need to understand how much it costs when you bounce a check, which is a lot.
Yeah.
Now.
Well, and it costs a lot if you have a low balance in a checking account.
That's right.
To have that checking account. Aren't you wasting a child? If they got $100 in a checking account, aren't you wasting their money on fees?
Yeah, you know, in the old days, most banks had free checking of some sort. It's a little bit rarer today. Mm-hmm. Some of them have special accounts for students that may allow the learning process. But it comes back to how much is the learning process worth? And I think it's worth something if you help them avoid the big mistakes.
And would you advocate making them actually physically write checks on their checking account or give them a debit card?
It's more painful that way to write checks.
That's
There's
right.
no question. And we do in our business. And a lot of people have the automatic draft and stuff like that, which is okay. But you don't feel the pain that you feel when you write checks. And the pain is important when you look at this thing and say, whoa, I went in there and I bought this new suit, and I didn't realize it cost X dollars because I didn't look at the thing. I just signed the you know, the tab, so to speak. Then I get the bill on it, and it's a lot bigger than I thought. But it's on the debit card, and it's already been deducted, so it's kind of hard to, you know, take back.
The other thing that I was told by my father, don't put things that you're going to consume today on credit.
The valid use of credit is to create an asset. It's okay to use credit to buy a house. It's okay to use credit to buy a car because when that transaction is completed,
you got something.
It's not okay to use credit to draw on a line of credit or a credit card that you can't pay off to go to dinner or to go on vacation because there's no asset created out of that.
I want to come back to that in just a couple of seconds with Larry Carroll and Bill State and Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Charlotte Magazine. The August issue features a favorite city skyline shot, embracing NASCAR, eating where the chefs do, and a list of 50 things every Charlottean should do. Now on newsstands, details at charlottemagazine.com. An experimental drug given to two Americans who contracted Ebola has sparked controversy over who gets treatment. An update on the effectiveness of the drug and efforts to contain the spread of this deadly virus will be the topic of the conversation 20 minutes at 10 o'clock on the Diane Rehm Show. If you'd like to join our conversation about money, about kids and money, about money and money, about you and money, WFAE.org/Charlotte Talk will get you to us, as will Facebook and Twitter, and we're coming right back.
I'm Peter Sagal. Did you know that your old car can support Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me? And no, I don't mean it waits until you're inside the house, then turns on the Bluetooth to call the station and donate your money. It can't do that, though it does like to prank order pizza for the Volvo down the block. What I mean is donating your car can help pay for shows like mine. So donate your old car and turn it into the programs you love.
Call 1-866-789-8627.
Or go to WFAE.org.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about money, about investing, about the money system, about teaching kids about how to use money and how to save money and how to treat money and what it costs. Bill Staton is with us. He's Managing Director of Staton Financial Advisors and the author of Double Your Money in America's Finest Companies. Larry Carroll is President and CEO of Carroll Financial Associates, the company that bears his name, which I have to say at least once a program. I'm going to go back to debt. Larry, you say, and you just kind of paraphrase this, there's only one appropriate use for debt, and that is to acquire a necessary and major asset like an education or a house or a car. It is not to go to Morton's and buy a $150 meal because you've eaten that meal and you've got nothing to show for it. Now, what if you pay your credit card bill in full every month? Isn't that the same as cash?
It is, but if you're able to pay it off every month, that's a good thing. That means, you know, I have no problem with charging it if you're in the position to pay it off. It's charging it when you are making the minimum monthly payment each month that's the problem.
Because if you go to a sale and everything is 25% off and you put it on your MasterCard or Visa card and you don't pay it off, you've just lost the 25% off. Or more.
You think a lot like my wife does. That's the way she explains things to me.
Savvy
I
lady
saved you this
is.
Money.
Is that wrong?
I bought this stuff and saved you a lot of money today.
But is that wrong? I mean, because the credit card interest is what, 25% or something like that?
It can be. I've given up on telling her she's wrong. So,
okay.
Smart man, Larry. Right. Smart man.
You can tell me because you don't have to live with me. You can tell me that's wrong. And debt. Let's talk about student debt because that's in the news everywhere today because people are accumulating enormous amounts of student debt. And you say, I just said that you said, it's okay to use debt to acquire an education.
It is, but it should be an education that prepares you for a job and provides a skill.
So this past week, they released some income figures. If you go to the University of North Carolina and major in, I think it was nuclear physics or something like that, you're going to make, coming out of college, $80,000, $90,000 a year. If you major in theater, you'll be lucky to make 10.
That's correct.
But you'll have the same debt if you put it on student debt.
Yes, you will. And the rule of thumb, I got this from Wingate University. I was on their board for 4 years, and I think it's a great rule of thumb. When you come out of college, the amount of student debt that you have should not exceed your starting salary.
Whoa. Well, how will you know what your starting salary is?
Well, I mean, if you're preparing for something, there's data out there that will tell you, and the placement
you get
office
indicators.
Can tell you.
Yeah, you get indicators.
That says is if you're borrowing money on student debt to get an accounting degree or an engineering degree, you'll be okay. And there's plenty of jobs, and they pay well. If you're doing it for theater, you've probably got a problem.
So what do you do? What if your love is something that doesn't pay a gazillion, like a school teacher? You need an education to be a school teacher. So what if it doesn't pay enough to pay the debt off? What do you do?
Well, it probably says you need to work harder while you're in college rather than just borrowing the money
to pay for it. Pay part of it as you go?
As you go. I think that's exactly the answer.
Now, there was a recent editorial in the Wall Street Journal about College of the Ozarks. Every single student who graduates has a job. It's like 99.5% right when they graduate. All of them end up leaving school with zero student debt, and all of them contribute to their education by working sometime during their college.
How did that happen for that school?
Well, it's just the way they set it up. And you have to go to their website and study it a lot more. But it's a very intriguing concept, and I think their graduates, from what I'm able to gather, I've looked at it from two, three different sources, are very, very attractive people because they already know something about not piling on a bunch of debt just to go in and learn something like basket weaving that really doesn't have any economic value.
You go into high schools. You've already talked about going into the prison system and teaching people about money, but you go into high schools to share, I think, investment knowledge, maybe other things about money. Well, how much do kids know when you walk in the door the first time? Do they know anything about money?
I wouldn't say a lot of them know a lot, but they come up. I usually have a list, Mike, of and ask them to come up with 20 or 25 ways that they waste money, because that's something that everybody understands.
Are they interested in learning more about money?
I found them extremely interested. I found the inmates at down here at the county jail have been enamored with this information. In fact, a guy came up to me after my session. It's only 1 hour, a couple of years ago, and he said, "Bill." He's 53. He said, "Bill, if I had known what you just taught 25 years ago, I wouldn't be here." Mm-hmm. That's how important this is, because a lot of people commit crimes simply because they don't know what else to do to take care of, say, a little baby or, you know, a newborn.
You talked about, both of you have talked about making a list of how you spend your money and constructing a budget and sticking to the budget.
Yeah.
But you say that you want everybody to know everything that you didn't know at 18. You didn't know what investing was or how to do it. You didn't know how to become wealthy on as little as $50 a month, which is something that you advocate now. You say that you can start $50 a month at a young age and achieve accumulating more money than you will ever need.
It's true if you start it and you stick with it. And the $50 a month came up simply because if you're on a direct investing program, the minimum to add to your initial investment is generally only $25 or $50. In ExxonMobil, for example, if you own that, you can put in up to $250,000 a year, and they absorb all the commissions and the transactions cost. So if we're taking $50 that we're wasting and converting that into building some shares of IBM or Procter & Gamble or Colgate or whatever, a small amount of money can go a long way. I just did a seminar in Kannapolis a couple of months ago, and I showed a very simple example of how you can accumulate $1 million or more if you start in your 30s, simply by buying a less expensive car. You can afford one at this level, but at a lower level is the one you buy.
Okay,
and investing the difference.
So if you take, if you're going to make, see, people, this is a thing we should talk about too. People go in and say, "Well, all I care about is my monthly payment." That,
right.
And that's the wrong way to approach buying a
car.
It is. But if you can afford a $30,000 a year car, you're saying go buy the $25,000 or $20,000 a year car. Take that extra money that you'd pay to the $30,000 payment and put it in an investment every month?
Save it to pay off your debt or something.
Same thing goes for buying a house?
Well, there are plenty of people in Charlotte and probably elsewhere that have huge homes with not much in them. And how many rooms do you need that you don't use?
A lot of people got themselves in trouble prior to the bubble bursting in 2008 by buying too much house or more house than they could afford and buying loans, because you're buying the loan, buying loans that they didn't understand and really couldn't afford, and part of the fault for that is on the lender, not just on the buyer. But what do people need to know about that? About buying a house, about getting a mortgage, about getting a car loan? What do they need to know?
Well, that the interest costs are terrible, even at low interest rates. They mount up. If you
get a house at 3.25%, which if you buy a new house from some builders, you can buy it down to 3.25%. That's an historically low interest rate. Why is that expensive?
Well, ask them to show you if you take out a 15 or 20 or 30 year loan, how much interest you'll pay if you ride the thing all the way out.
But most people don't stay in a house for 30 years.
I think where it gets more expensive is if you use that as an excuse to buy a $300,000 house when you ought to be buying a $225,000 house.
Why? Why ought you be buying a $225,000 if you can get in at 3.25%?
Before 2008, I bet I've had 100 times where clients or prospects have said to me, "You don't lose money in real estate."
Mm-hmm.
And that's why they wanted to buy the bigger house or the rental property. Now, nobody said that since 2008. they've learned a lesson there. But, you know, the house is a place to live. And I think that we really got sidetracked on this idea of the house being a great investment.
It's not.
At certain points in time, it's okay. But it's not. The only reason is the main reason it's turned out to be a great investment for a lot of people is they can't buy and sell it every month. They end up living there and paying down the mortgage and end up almost because of the process, they end up with a lot of equity in it.
People didn't used to think of houses as being an investment. They thought of them as places to live, and they wanted the nicest place they could afford to live, and over time they could make it nicer. But houses also cost money along the way. The air
All
conditioning
the way.
Breaks down. The roof has to be replaced. You have to paint the outside and the inside. It costs money, don't it?
Absolutely, and that's the part they tend to underestimate or ignore in stretching to buy the bigger house because they think it will be a good investment. There is a lot of other expenses, as you say, that come with it.
But won't they get that money out when they go to sell it?
Maybe, maybe not.
What about buying a car? Because kids like to buy cars when they hit 17, 18, 19. If daddy hadn't bought them a BMW yet, they'll go out and buy a car. You're always at a disadvantage when you buy a car because the people at the dealership know how to sell a car,
but
you don't know how to buy one.
there are some great buying services. Costco has one. Hartford Insurance has one. AAA has one. I have used.
What makes them good?
Mary and I have used AAA on four different occasions and gotten a better deal, if you will, than we were able to secure on our own. And interestingly, one of the cars we bought, the better deal came from AAA, but it was the same dealer we had talked with who was going
to. Is that because they have buying power?
They have a lot of influence.
I think the bigger issue is that is a business or a transaction that the internet has changed because you can compare prices from a lot of different places.
And you can and you know what the dealer
and you
has
know,
in it.
Yeah, you know what the markups are. I think that's. The internet has disrupted the car buying process in a good way.
Isn't it disrupting the house buying process? Because you can go online and now instead of going to the courthouse and spending days and days, and days you can find out what the owner of the house paid for the house. And
I don't know, Mike. There's something a little bit unnerving to me. I heard a commercial on Saturday. There's somebody. He's a house flipper and he's looking for 20 good people to join his house flipping team to make $10,000 to $40,000 a year in their spare time, and he's giving some seminars in this area, I think here in Charlotte. And we heard that kind of talk back in 04, 05, and 06.
Well, all the house flipping shows disappeared off those cable channels. They're back.
Yeah, yep. they're coming back. Yeah.
Go ahead.
I want to go back for a minute to the budgeting issue. One of the things I've learned in 34 years is it is very difficult, if not impossible, to take a person who's not inclined to budget and doesn't budget and just turn them into a budgeter. So the way I've approached it with most clients over time is I don't want to be involved in how much you spend on vacations or how often you eat out. That's up to you. What we can't lose sight of is the big picture, which is income needs to be higher than outflows. So it's not that much about the line items because you make personal choices as to what to spend that money on in terms of line items. It's more about the bigger issue that you're spending less than you're making.
And you have to have discipline.
That's right.
If you're spending more than you're making, you got to figure out, okay, then I just can't do that. Yep. And that's hard to do.
And again,
in
Mike,
America,
so much of American spending is wasteful. It's not just like wars and overseas in Iraq and Afghanistan. It's just money wasted. It's not producing any satisfaction to the people that they're just spending it. A 5,000 square foot home, very few people need.
But it's become fun. Shopping is fun.
But it becomes a burden to you. Money is a wonderful servant. It's a terrible master.
Okay. And from Providence High School, please know that in 10th grade, the idea of credit and investing is taught as part of the North Carolina C&E curriculum. Personal financial literacy was added to the curriculum about 3 years ago. Good. We have students do budgets, buy stocks, buy in quotes, and learn about saving and investment. I attended the North Carolina Council on Economics Education held at the Charlotte Fed last week to learn more strategies to teach exactly what you're talking about. That organization runs the stock market game for classes to participate in. Economics is best learned hands-on and by participating, and we do our best to teach this information.
That's great.
It's terrific.
On your website, Larry, you have a series that you refer to as must-read articles, among them teaching your kids about money, in which you talk about people running into financial predators who sell high commission investments, annuities, or unnecessary life insurance coverage. Who should and should not buy annuities and life insurance?
Well, life insurance needs to be needs-driven. There's a lot of reasons to own life insurance if there are things you need to provide for in the event of your death, like providing for a spouse or children and educating children. You need to go through a process of identifying exactly what the need is and then buy the insurance to fill the need. I think way too many people, particularly young people, but retirement-oriented people also, way too many of them buy annuities. There are some valid uses for annuities, but if you really understand the math, they are very expensive products for funding retirement income. It's complicated, but at the same time, it tends to be very mathematical. You just crunch through the numbers the correct way and understand it.
Mark wants to know when you start spending some of the money you set aside for retirement. How do you figure that out? And we have 5 seconds.
I have a table I can send him.
All right. We're going to put some information about Larry Carroll from Carroll Financial Associates and Bill Staten from Staten Financial Advisors on our website, because they have a lot of information on their website that you could find valuable for yourself and for your children. Thanks for the hour.
Charlotte Talks with Mike Collins is a production of 90.7 WFAE. Our executive producer is Wendy Herc.